All right, good evening, everybody, and welcome to Open Paddock Radio Live. Sean joining you this week, as I always do. And I have with me the guys who are always the partner in crime. Mike, say hello.
Good evening.
Yes. And Doug, say hello.
Hello.
All right.
See, I can follow directions.
It's a, you know...
Okay, Doug, you have 2 minutes for Mazda Road to Indy. Go.
I started to say, there has never been a...
I don't follow those directions.
There's never been a more bullshit statement I've ever heard from you, Doug. So,
all right.
Well, we have a lot going on the show, so thanks for joining us. We have lots of people in the chat. We have quite a few people, actually, in the chat room. Coming to you live from ETV Live, also ET Live Radio, powered by the HD Radio Network. You can hear us on iTunes at all times. Well, not all times, but you can listen to ETV Live on the iTunes. You can hear, you know, good rock and roll music. You just heard some awesome stuff. If you were listening, you heard the Toto song, Africa. I was telling the boys right before we went live how much I like that song. And then I think we replay our show at like 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. So tune in to the HD Radio Network for our show to be replayed. But thanks for joining us, as always. And we got a lot to talk about tonight. We're going to try to do it in a rather quick fashion, but some things do bear talking about. And that we're going to start, obviously, with the motorsports in brief. Then we're going to move on to IndyCar. And then we have Mazda Road Indy as well that we'll deal with. Actually, Doug will deal with. And there's a lot of stuff there, so we'll dedicate the last half an hour of the show to him. No, so, but we've got lots to talk about. And let's talk about, first and foremost, probably next to the... next to the Indy 500, my favorite of, well, probably next to the Indy 500 and the Monte Carlo Rally, my favorite event of the year, and that is the Formula One race at Spa, the Belgian Grand Prix. So we had that this weekend, so no better way to come back from the Formula One summer break than to go to Spa, because it is quite possibly, I always caveat by saying Indianapolis is better, but, you know, sometimes I actually think that I'm lying to myself because I just love Spa that much. But I guess, like I always say, Indianapolis is always going to be my favorite oval, regardless, and my favorite facility. But if I had any road course in the world that I could go to, it would be Spa. So, and it is on the bucket list.
Hmm.
So, but I heard that like a lot of the creature comforts that made Spa so great kind of went away. Like, I guess they were talking about on the broadcast, they lost a lot of the food vendors that they usually have at the racetrack that actually serve like the fries and the mayo. Which I guess is such a big deal there, and I guess you couldn't get that anymore. Well, I guess you could get those, but you couldn't get certain things. And I guess there was a lot of Belgian waffle stands, which is kind of disappointing because it just kind of feeds into the stereotype of, you know, it's like, oh, you guys make waffles, don't you? And shoes?
See, they're nothing like what we get here, though. We have a Belgian waffle stand at our local downtown market, and they're phenomenal. I mean, they're these crispy rounds. They're just they're wonderful. And the guy who serves them to you speaks in this ridiculous Belgian accent. It's just great. So,
it's been cultivated over years with a voice coach.
Nice. Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah. So apparently, okay. So Nick in the chat room, he's going to Spa with me, I suppose. Just kind of creepy. I hope he doesn't kill me.
Nice.
No, but let's talk.
Don't worry, I got your six. I'm going to.
Oh, sweet. Okay.
Yeah. We'll make it an OP adventure.
Nice.
That is on my bucket list.
Could you see it? It'd be
as
like,
soon as we raise that advertising revenue we've been talking about, right?
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Q, looking to sponsor, looking to advertise.
Nice.
because we sure as the hell are. No, but we're going to be talking about. Let's talk about qualifications actually first, because that's where a lot of interesting stuff happens. And you know, Spa is one of those places that has the ability to throw out some really crazy results. You know, it's one of those. It's like Indianapolis, man. It's like one of those tracks where it's such a big event, and so many people take so much time to
and
make
so different from all the other events on the circuit this year.
Yeah, yeah.
It's super long straights, hardly any real slow speed corners, you know. It's just so different. So
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a proper road course, honestly. And I was you know, they were talking about the 9 mile like road course that they used to have out there, the old track, and I was like, man, what I wouldn't do to see an F1 car roll through there just once. But yeah, qualifying threw us some interesting surprises, and nothing bigger than Kamui Kobayashi from Japan throwing up a stunning second place run in qualifying. I mean, that was huge because you had obviously the normal way of qualifying, basically. I mean, you had the usual guys, the Hamiltons, the Alonzos, and all that. And then in the top five, you have Kobayashi as well as Sergio Perez. And I mean, it was just an unbelievable run for Sauber this weekend. During qualifying, that is.
Indeed. When you have both Sauber Ferraris qualifying ahead of both Ferraris, it's usually something worth noting.
It was just a great run. I seen, because I'll admit, I didn't watch qualifying in its entirety. I kind of just fast-forwarded through the Cliff Notes version. It was stunning how Kobayashi was able to put that Sauber in P2 of all places. Some slightly more disappointing results came out of Sebastian Vettel, who could only get 11th. Granted, he would move to 10th after the, I believe there was a penalty.
Maldonado moved back. Was it Maldonado, or am I thinking wrong?
No, I don't think it was Maldonado. It was... who was it? I can't remember who it was, actually. I can't remember. Maybe somebody in the chat room.
That's the next race. Pastor gets moved back 2 10-spot grid penalties for the next race. One for jumping the start, and one for a engine change. So
yeah, it was yeah. Anyways, that, you know, and honestly, we'll get to the jump start when we get into the race, but that was close. That was close to being the greatest start of all time.
Indeed.
But he just biffed it. And I think he may have gotten away from it if he wouldn't have went on the radio and said, "Oh, my hand slipped off the clutch."
You know, I was watching it, and I agree with the speed guys that it sure did look clean to me.
Well, the thing that was tough and the thing that they weren't showing you is the view of Maldonado. We'll get to it. Hang on. Other things, Michael Schumacher, he didn't run very well, being this his 300th Grand Prix. Big deal about Schumacher. I was a little disappointed myself, but he would make up for it with a pretty good race. He did run well. So really, I mean, it wasn't too much, I guess, out of the ordinary for qualifying, minus the Saubers were up there, and that was obviously a huge deal. And then Maldonado had a pretty good run himself. Romain Grosjean doing well. Kimi Raikkonen also doing well, which was a big deal because the Lotus cars were fancied to do well in the race, and a lot of people thought that Kimi was going to win the race. And I even started to kind of believe that Kimi was going to win the race there for a while because, you know, they've been so good and so consistent all year. And then we get to the start of the race, which is where everything just came apart. Maldonado jumped the start. And now back to the point of that, though. The one thing that the speed guys never got, and to their credit, you know, they're brilliant. I mean, there's no better way to say it. But the fact is this, when you look at what actually happened, the camera angles that they were looking at, you could not really see Maldonado well enough to see if maybe that car just lurched forward a little bit. Because the one that you always saw was the lights, and then you seen Maldonado, and then you seen it was the front aspect shot, you know, at the very end by Lesores. You know, you couldn't see
it takes a bit before your eye registers the movement
of
the cars.
And that could be
because of the long angle of the shot.
Exactly. And then the second shot was the overhead blimp shot or whatever, the helicopter they had cruising around the racetrack all weekend, which was really freaking cool. But you couldn't they didn't have the lights pulled up. You couldn't see the lights in relation to when he jumped.
Yeah.
So it was really impossible to tell, but it looked really close, and I thought for a second that he pulled it off.
The only view that really seemed somewhat definitive was not necessarily that you could see the lights, but when they are showing Charlie Whiting in the starter stand and he starts waving his finger as soon as the start happens, you're like, this isn't going to end well for him.
Yeah, because like Charlie Whiting is like losing his damn mind in there. He's just like, he's like, Hulk smash, no, you can't do that. And I was like, holy cow, dude, chill out.
Yeah,
but
Charlie Whiting pressed the release the Grosjean button. Mm-hmm. And that takes us into turn one.
Yeah. He uncaged Grosjean a bit too soon. And I don't know what the hell he was thinking, but they were, because it was not, what, another 150 feet down the track, and all hell broke loose.
Yeah.
That was probably one of the bigger Formula One crashes we've seen. I'd say that was probably one of the more horrific F1 crashes we've seen in years, and probably the scariest thing that we've seen since Mark Webber ran into the back of the Slotus or whatever that was at the time, and did an aerial backflip and nearly crushed his dome piece on the asphalt. That was a horrific accident because then he went hard into the tires. But this one, I mean, just the sheer, like, carbon fiber explosion, cars catapulting over one another. Fernando Alonso just about had his face taken off by the Lotus of Grosjean. I mean, that was scary. I mean, when you look back at it, I mean, say what you will, everybody walked away, and it was a low-speed turn one. That was genuinely scary.
Well, it was. Yeah. You know, especially as close as... who was it that came over the top? Was it,
it was Grosjean?
Mm-hmm. Nearly decapitating Alonso.
Yeah, that was close.
But for about a foot and a half. So that's really what made it extremely scary and nerve wracking was Grosjean's car in as close proximity as it was to Alonso's skull.
And Alonso, to his credit, granted, Alonso is, you know, he's a driver's driver. He's a man's man, basically. But you could tell the reason he didn't get out of that car was because his heart was probably about to come out of his throat. Because you got to look at it. That was scary. And for a man like Alonso, I mean, that could have ended really badly had it not been for maybe another 0.3 seconds faster that he went into that corner. We're talking about him being done. I mean, it really brought about the human aspect of racing when you see an Alonso still in his car, not because he's hurt, not because he's trapped, but because for one split second, Alonso was a man, and he was afraid.
A mortal man.
Yeah, a mortal man, and he was afraid, because that was really scary.
Yeah, that really was a life in front of your eyes moment. It genuinely was. And I'm sure he had to take a moment to recompose himself.
Yeah, because, yeah. I mean, I showed my friends the video at work today. I was like, you got to see this. I mean, this is just chaotic. I mean, it was chaotic because carbon fiber is going everywhere, but look at how close it gets to this guy's dome piece. And it was just like, you know, I was like, that is scary. And everybody was, you know, they agreed, obviously, but they don't understand just to the extent. But, anyways, turn one calamity would bring out the safety car. That's what we had to deal with. What's Spa without a safety car, it almost seems. Because, you know, like they said during the TV coverage, anytime at Spa when you go off, you don't just have a minor off.
There are no minor offs.
No, when you go off at Spa, it's going to hurt. And it's going to hurt pretty bad. And there's going to be pieces everywhere. And that's kind of what we had happen in turn one. So we had the safety car. Jenson Button, who started on pole position, his first pole position since 2009, if you can believe that, mm-hmm. because he's won a whole lot more races than that. But a fantastic job by both Jenson Button and Sebastian Vettel as well, really making the one-stop strategy work for them. And that was really the highlight of the weekend because there were a number of two-stop strategies that, you know, were afoot. I think it was Michael Schumacher thought, you know, perhaps, you know, mm-hmm. one stop was in the cards. And then the tires, you know, I mean, the tires just wouldn't, they just wouldn't cooperate, and he had to make that stop. And you heard Ross Brawn come on the radio and say, Michael, we're switching to plan B. And sure enough, here he comes ducking into the pits, so...
Yeah, and the drama of the race was Kimi Raikkonen, and he had tires in hand, and he had pace and all that kind of stuff, but he was never anywhere close. So
no, it was really disappointing, honestly, when you hear all the hype and everything that was built up about Kimi and Lotus in this race, and they just didn't come to play. And what happened was it all came down to the downforce game. They were running too much downforce. Their wing, in relation to like the Mercedes and any of the other cars that were out there, was just so much larger. The profile was so much larger than the other cars, and that was where they were really having a hard time keeping up on that straightaway. They, it's not like Red. In order to do what Red Bull does, which is do amazingly well when they're not fast in a straight line, you have to have a car that's built to perfection. And Lotus doesn't have Adrian Newey, and so that's why that didn't pan out for them.
Well, Lotus, they do have one asset, but not for Monza. Roman Grosjean has been suspended one race for really setting off that whole chain reaction. He came down on Lewis Hamilton, who was peeking to the inside, and just shut the door on him and just blew the whole field apart going into turn one.
Yeah.
You had Kamui Kobayashi, who qualified so well, he got taken out in that mess. Both Saubers got taken out in that mess in a roundabout way. But D'Ambrosio is going to sub for him at Monza, so, when we get to picks for Monza, he's my pick for first out.
Oh, shit.
Exactly. But this did bring up some interesting conversation after the weekend. They were talking about closed cockpits. They're starting to get pushed again for 2014. They never went away. It's just we're hearing about them again because of this incident.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to think, is this going to be one of those things that always lasts, or is it going to be every time we have one of these, let's talk about it? I mean,
Well, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I think they just need to come out with a case that goes around the car.
Like a little...
Have OtterBox make it.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's just indestructible.
So the next time a phone company comes, it says, I've got a great idea. Let's make a phone made entirely of glass. We'll put an OtterBox on it, and it works.
Nice. Good call. I like that.
Anyway, moving forward.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I do want to bring up one point regarding the closed cockpit. You're right. Every time something like this comes up, we will hear about this. However, something that started to stir in some of the conversations that I've had online has been moving beyond the safety and just wondering, why are we so insistent on this formula, on this having an open cockpit and open wheels? Why are we so fixated on that? If Formula One is supposed to be the pinnacle of motorsport, why not design the car to be as maximally efficient as it can be? Whether that's closed wheels, open wheels, closed cockpit, open cockpit, whatever maximally efficient single-seater design you want, go for it. Why are we still shackled with... essentially, this goes right back to the Marmon Wasp form factor, right? Except the only difference is the engine's in the back instead of in the front.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
There are really a few more differences.
You get what I'm saying, though, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, indeed. Is it because of nostalgia that we continue to insist on the open cockpit, or is there something more to it? Is it just because we want differentiation between our form of racing and sports car racing?
I don't know. I personally think, I think that it's the same thing that is to be said true about IndyCar. I mean, if anything, you want to talk about closed cockpits, why aren't we talking about them in IndyCar after what happened, last year?
Well, we did for a while,
well,
right?
Well, we did, but then it went away. Because at the end of the day, people are not people watch Formula One and they watch IndyCar because they're open-wheel cars with open cockpits. It's that people are not attracted necessarily. I mean, they are attracted to the racing. I'm attracted to the racing in IndyCar and Formula One. I have no problem saying that. But there is an inherent danger with open wheels and open cockpit that draws people to watch it because it says, hey, look how dangerous this is. This guy's dome piece is exposed out of the car, and, you know, what's going to stop it from getting taken clean off, as we've seen clearly at Spa, you know, and it's just, that's what it is. People, you know, people like that inherent danger that open wheels and open cockpit produce.
Yeah, I don't know if that actually is a driving aspect of the viewership, to be honest. But, you know, we can get sidetracked on this.
Ring the bell, JD. Ring the bell.
Night. But, you know, I just wanted to bring it up, and maybe we come back to this during the off season when there's less happening. And, you know, because one of the things, if we want to stick with this open wheel, open cockpit format, fine. But really, if we do say that, then I don't think, I don't think we can say now that Formula One is the pinnacle of motorsport. I don't think they're the one pushing automotive technology. I think that belongs with Le Mans.
I will definitely agree.
But anyway, we can debate this some other time.
The reason I wanted to put it on the schedule, and this will close it, is, you know, these closed cockpits, they're gathering steam. The FIA has been in secret firing tire cannons at cockpit, you know, mock-ups for months now, ever since Massa and Henry Surtees. And this is just another thing that brings it back out in the public. Yes, this is going on behind the scenes. And when we get a completely new formula in 2014 with the engines, don't be surprised if there's some more driver protection. If it's just a couple of bars along the side of the driver just to protect the driver a little bit more, or if it's an enclosed sprint car canopy, there's something that's going to come in 2014. So be prepared. That said, we need to get the results of the race. The results, obviously, Jensen Button for the win. That's fantastic. Jensen Button wins. Sebastian Vettel pulling up from 10th to 2nd.
That was a great drive.
Fantastic drive for him.
Yeah. Much props to Vettel.
Kimi never really capitalized on the awesomeness that he supposedly had this weekend with tires in hand and speed and everything, so he ended up finishing 3rd. Other notables, Massa finished 5th. That's another good result from him, even though we're coming to expect much less. Schumacher ended up finishing 7th. Not the best race for him. As the race went on, he ended up losing 6th gear and dropped a lot of spots, so too bad. Other than that, Naren Kartikeyan ended up in the kitty litter. No big surprise there. And we do need to talk about the championship because Alonso is now 24 points ahead of Sebastian Vettel. Yep. Going on to Monza, Mark Webber is floundering just 8 points back of Vettel. So you know what? This is still tight, and it's going to remain tight because Fernando does not have the best car.
No, he clearly doesn't. But I don't think that Red Bull have the best car either. I'd fancy to say that if I had to pick a car, that was probably. I mean, you can't pick a car that's the best. There is no best car this year. There is no one.
Which weekend are you best?
Yeah, exactly. What weekend do you have the best stuff? I'd have to say that it would right now be a tie, I think, between the McLaren Mercedes. And honestly, I think the Lotus Renault is one of the best cars on the grid. And the reason I say it is look at the way they finished. They've been the most consistent car and driver combos, minus Grosjean. But
once again, they're ahead of Ferrari in the Constructors' Championship.
Well, exactly, and that's just it. I mean, Red Bull Renault is up at the top. Red Bull Racing at the top, and that is just because Vettel and Webber find points. And they're constantly a threat for victory. Same with McLaren Mercedes. The thing with Red Bull Renault, though, is the last few races, they haven't been running so hot. Whereas Lotus, you know, they haven't taken a win, per se, but they are finishing more consistently than probably anybody else on the grid, and always find themselves in kind of the best, you know, in the best position. I think I would have to call it. It would be McLaren Mercedes and Lotus Renault are my guess as the best cars on the grid. However, luck being what it is, and also plays into the whole entire thing as well, that is another problem, because, you know, you've got Grosjean, you know, Grosjean's done okay in some instances, but there's also times, like this weekend, where Grosjean is the horse's ass. And it's kind of like Ferrari, you know, if Ferrari had a quality number two, and not a sagging Felipe Massa, who's all but fired at the end of the year, how good would they be doing? I mean, so, you know, you got to look at it that way. I mean, McLaren Mercedes has got the best driver lineup in the field with Button and Hamilton, as much as I hate to say it because I despise Hamilton. I think that they've got the best pairing, and I think that, you know, but I think that Lotus, if they had another good number two driver in that car, not that I don't think they can afford it, but they would be probably the best, they would probably be one of the best as well, and would be scoring more points, and might be more of a threat to Mercedes, McLaren Mercedes, or maybe even Red Bull, because they've finished more consistently this year. But enough of that. What, are we on to the championship standings now? Oh, you said
we already talked about that. So let's jump in, because we need to discuss Monza. Monza's coming up next weekend. Back to back venerable racetracks, and the rest of the year is on these crappy little Tilke drums. did I say that?
Oh, don't worry. It's okay if you did, because they're in fact shit.
So moving into Monza, more of the same. What do you think for the picks for the weekend? I'm definitely down with Alonso for the win, because it's on Ferrari home turf. Vettel for second, Hamilton for third, and D'Ambrosio, I'm sorry, you're out first.
Nice. Well, I'm going to take Vettel for the win after what they showed me last year at Monza, after I wrote them off as not being the best. Yeah, you can shut the hell up, Doug, because I know why you're laughing. That cost me a damn martini at a very nice Italian restaurant.
It was tasty, tasty, tasty.
Yes, the food was great. No. Actually, I was there this weekend, Doug. I even tweeted you a picture.
Yeah. Oh, and I didn't see the picture. Oh. I saw the tweet, but I didn't see the picture.
Well, just as a reminder, I need to talk to you after the show about said restaurant. But I will take Vettel for the win. I will take Alonso P2, and I'm going to take Jenson Button P3, and I'm going to take my first out as being Romain Grosjean. Oh, wait. Shit. He's our... I will say that my first out, I'm going to say... I'll say... I'm not going to say Ambrosio. I'll say one of the Scuderia Torosos. I'll say Vern.
Vern. Okay, who was your second and third? I'm sorry. Didn't get those down.
It was Alonso second, and third will be Jenson Button.
Button. Okay, Doug, for your picks.
At first I was thinking of Hamilton, but after this week, I don't think he's getting any new parts. They'll be lucky if they put a race cart under his ass. I think the win is going to be Button. I really like the high speed performance of the McLaren they showed there at Spa, and Monza, another high speed track. So,
would you care to make a wager?
not after so much wheat wine style ale.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, this is only going to deteriorate as this show continues. Button, Alonso, and Vettel, I think. That's my pick. First out, Kamui.
Okay. We got that taken care of. A couple of things to wrap up from Formula One this week. Number one, what Doug alluded to. Lewis Hamilton tweeted the whole effing paddock.
Whole effing planet or whole effing paddock?
The whole effing world. Nice. Check out my mad telemetry, yo.
Oops. Oops. Yeah, please don't say that. I'm sure that McLaren was not happy about that.
Yeah, you just every engineer in the paddock was immediately pulling an all-nighter.
Oh, yeah.
that telemetry trace in gory detail.
Oh, yeah. You know that, like, Nui and the boys at Red Bull are like, holy shit, look at this.
They're like, no, he didn't.
They're like, look at this gold mine. So, yeah, that was, you know, and this kind of environment, and the kinds of stuff, you know, with the job, you know, I am staunchly opposed to putting out, you know, any kind of information about any of, you know, our capabilities within the military, you know, the Air Force, the jets and everything. You know, you never want to say too much about it. And this guy is basically taken like a top secret shot of his information and posted it for every enemy in the world to just be like, oh really? Well, we got your kryptonite.
This is ridiculous. I mean, you can find all the state secrets of the United States of America on WikiLeaks, but you cannot find F1 data. Good job, Lewis.
I was going to say, F1 hires better people.
Yeah, well, we can't help little douchebag specialists. So yeah. We'll deal with him. Don't worry about
anyway. Two more quick hits from F1, then we will move on to some other meat. Formula One, Cosworth has announced that they are intending to stay in 2014. Doesn't mean they're building an engine right now. It means they're exploring options with teams to possibly build an engine. All that said is that, you know, a lot of people have been making comments that there will only be three engines, you know, and Pure bowed out, so definitely only three engines unless Cosworth is coming in. And Cosworth took exception to that and said, wait a second, we might be there. So I don't take too much stock in this until they actually sign a team. And even then, you really can't make it with just one team. So we'll just withhold judgment until later. But I'd still say my bet is Cosworth is not around for 2014. It's a big investment, and I don't think it's really worked out for them being around in this last engine package. The other thing to note about F1 is that the Concorde Agreement negotiations are still going on behind the scenes, and one of the things in flux was the FIA is wanting a cut. The commercial rights holder was trying to keep them out of it. There have been things like the tracks trying to get a cut, the FIA trying to get a cut, the teams trying to get a bigger cut, and then the rights holder trying to get a bigger cut. And in the end, it looks like the FIA hasn't gotten the cut they wanted because they are looking at hiking the entry fee for the teams to massive proportions. Based on last year's points and the direction they want to take this, Red Bull would have to pay something on the order of 5 million euros just to compete in F1. McLaren around 4 million, Ferrari around 3 million. This is all based on the points they scored in the previous year and things of that nature. This is significantly up over their entry cost because right now the entry for a team right now is around 309,000 euros with an escalator based on points, but it's nothing close to what this is. Pretty crazy stuff. So moving on from Formula One, we're moving on to Grand Am and ALMS unification of Grand Am. Oh my goodness. This is not a unification. This is a outright purchase.
Hostile takeover.
Oh yeah. It's not really a hostile takeover, but it is a fact that if it's a duck, it's a duck. ALMS car count sucks unless it's GT. I'm not going to lie. The prototype count has been horrid. Grand Am has had a lot of Daytona prototypes, and they've had a lot of GT cars. Granted, their GT cars are not the same caliber as the ALMS GT cars, which I like a lot better. But, yeah, this is Grand Am saying, look. And this is also probably ALMS saying, look, we're not going to last much longer. Our car counts are terrible. All the main heavy hitters have went to the WEC. We don't have a leg to stand on. We're going to fold before long. And this is Grand Am saying, ooh, this is a great time to bring them in. However, the one thing that I don't get is, what the hell are they going to do with these cars? Because they're talking about bringing in every... They're talking about bringing, like, all the cars into one race. How do you do that? I mean, this is impossible. Now you're going to have LMP cars. You're going to have LMP1, LMP2, and then ALMS GT mix in with these slow shit show Daytona prototypes and these, like, amateur, really... I mean, these are, like, club-level racing GT cars in Grand Am.
It's lip service. They brought them in to destroy them, pure and simple, and eliminate competition.
And that's exactly it. ALMS is on tough times, but Grand Am has a sugar daddy, NASCAR. Grand Am is in a much better position to withstand a long-term not-doing-well situation. They've got the manufacturers involved because, well, if you want to be involved in Cup, maybe you should be involved in Grand Am, too. We can incentivize that. So, you know, it's just one of those losing battles, and Don Panos, I believe, saw that. He's reportedly getting an 8-figure check for the ALMS, and that's going to include not only the ALMS, it's also going to include Road Atlanta and the long-term lease that ALMS has on Sebring.
Dear Mr. Panos,
I hadn't thought that far down. So 12 hours to Sebring, it's done.
Well, it depends. I don't know what that's going to mean though, because the
Grand Am ain't going to run it.
Well, no, but the WEC,
they're going to run the 24 hours to Daytona.
Well, what and then what's that say?
Just move the dates. You just move the dates.
No, you know, it's too close.
Well, the FIA is not going to.
You just move the dates. It's too lucrative for Grand Am to just say let's just shit can it.
Well, yeah. They're not going to shit can the race. But the fact of the matter is this: the 12 hours of Sebring is a WEC event.
Mm-hmm. Now
that is a good statement.
Yeah. Because the other thing that's kind of in flux here, and let's throw this out just to stir the pot even more: the agreement that ALMS has with the ACO expires in 2013.
Okay.
So, Grand Am, do you think they're going to apply with the ACO to continue that agreement? Nope. I'd say no.
No, I'd say probably not. But that's just it. They're going to kill Sebring. They're going to kill Petit. And, I mean, honestly, the only other place that the WEC will really have to run in the United States will be at Circuit of the Americas.
Yep. Yeah, Circuit of the Americas. Yeah, maybe they could pick somewhere else to try, but
here's the fact of the matter though, is even if they go to the Circuit of the Americas, here's one thing they don't have on the side: nostalgia. The nostalgia of the 12 hours of Sebring as a premier sports car event in the world, not just the United States, in the world, and Petit Le Mans and its kind of surge, if you will, into the premier sports car, you know, venue that it's kind of become. I mean, you're going to lose those. And yeah, okay, let's take the WEC to Circuit of the Americas, which is going to be, I think, a good facility, and it'll be a great facility for the race, but you don't have the nostalgia of Sebring. You don't have the nostalgia of Petit. And that, I think, at the end of the day, is going to hurt it.
Or even if you create a new event at, if you create a new event someplace else, Watkins Glen, for example, at least you have the nostalgia of the venue, if not the event. But at Circuit of the Americas, brand new shiny course. It's new and shiny. It's neat, but you know you lack that.
What Grand Am is going to do though is they're going to take the luster of Petit Le Mans, they're going to take the luster of Sebring and fold that into the Grand Am world and try and ride on those coattails as best they can. It doesn't really matter about WEC because they don't care about WEC. They care about the U.S. series. John Dagies, you know, this press conference is going to go off tomorrow, so we may hear some more details that John Dagies isn't reporting at Speed. But according to his article that came out at Speed earlier this evening, the official class structures aren't expected to be announced tomorrow, but it's believed that the current Daytona prototypes will remain, the current Rolex Series GT categories will remain. The ALMS GT class will be rolled into that somehow, and the P2s could also feature, but probably equalized so they're potentially slower than the DP cars.
Well, they're gonna nerf the ALMS GT cars to put them in that same shit show amateur GT class that's running. Club racing is what it is.
What they need to do is take that Rolex GT series and roll that back in the Continental Tire stuff that they have going on, you know, as support races for those Grand Am weekends, and then put the GT cars out there to race with the Daytona prototypes because they probably beat them.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, they'd lap them.
If I had to pick between the Chevrolet Corvette DP and the Chevrolet Corvette and the Chevrolet
C6R,
I would pick the C6R.
Indeed. That's a monster. Yeah, well. So, all that said, the premier sports car racing series in the United States now is World Challenge. So,
yay!
Tune in. this is going to take off in 2014. All the agreements and track rentals and all that, all the TV deals and everything are already done for 2013. So all of this will take effect in 2014. So they'll run a separate series in 2013. We'll wait until tomorrow to hear more details, and I'm kind of excited to hear what they have to say. I'm hopeful that we'll hear some good news instead of just, look at our Daytona prototypes. Aren't they cool?
Wish in one hand, crap in the other. See what fills up first.
Yep. That's how I'm feeling. That's how I'm thinking.
Yeah.
To kind of throw, you know... Wonderful news today out of Rebellion. They are coming to Petit. They sound like the only European team that actually is coming over after the European Le Mans series kind of fell apart. Kind of a going theme there, isn't it? These Le Mans series not really going off. Anyway.
Hey,
we're coming to Petit. Oh.
Wait,
yeah.
It's run by Grand Dam?
Exactly.
What happened there?
Wait a second. Who said I had to put this NASCAR sticker on the back of my car?
Yeah, right? Yeah. Sprint Cup series.
We do have one bit of rally news.
We do. Well, tragic bit.
Tragic news. Mike Shaw, who just left the chat window there, Oregon Wings, at Oregon Wings on Twitter. Gave us yet another very nice op-ed piece about the tragedy at the Czech rally this past weekend, where a spectator unfortunately lost his life in an accident. This is a really nice article by Mike. Highly encourage y'all to give it a good read. But what was weird is that, you know, it's not like the desert races that, you know, where we saw all that sketchiness, what, a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah. Off-road truck.
Yeah, people standing where they had absolutely no business being. This was, you know, inside, elevated, you know, so in an area where you would expect a reasonable degree of safety, but just, you know, it's one of those cases that just reiterates that... In motorsports, any form of motorsports, things go pear-shaped real fast and in unexpected ways.
Well, especially in rally, given how close you are to the stages. I mean, you, Doug, you and I know probably more so, you know, when we go out to the rally, the 100 Acre Wood Rally. I mean, you and I, this past year, we were right there. I mean, they literally told me, they said, if you see a car spear off in your direction, you need to find... like a tree or something to jump behind to save yourself.
A big healthy tree.
Yeah, a big healthy tree.
Sapling piece of crap.
No, because they'll run over that or they'll ramp over it and still hit you. I mean, they literally told me, they said, that I remember because I said, I want to go into the photographer area because you had given me that Canon to take those pictures of the cars. And
Nikon.
I wanted to get, or, I'm sorry, yeah, Nikon, I'm sorry.
I'll slap you upside.
Choke yourself, Doug. And, but no, when they, when they let me go into that area, one, there were two rules. I had to be next to a marshal because I didn't have a vest like you did. And two, on the one stage where the cars were coming right at my face, they were like, hey, if it looks like for any reason this guy's going to miss the the corner and come into your area, you need to literally drop that camera, turn around, and run for your life behind a big tree and hope that the tree stops the car.
Yeah,
I mean, that's just
saying, run for your
no,
life.
No, that's what they said. Doing. Yeah, he said it. I mean, he didn't just laugh and say, run for your life, kid. I mean, he was like, no, if a car comes in your direction and loses control, you need to drop that camera and you need to get the hell out of here and get behind a tree. And I mean, that's just normal fans, because the fans line the stages. And, you know, on gravel with such a surface like that, it does not take much to lose control of the car.
No.
And spear off into a group of pedestrians who are just there to watch you. And, I mean, it's just really different than any other kind of motorsport that we cover from that aspect.
Any time I'm next to a track, whether it's an autocross, whether it's IndyCar at an oval, at a road course, or if it's at a rally, the number one thing I'm looking for is an escape route.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I don't care if you're... your credentialed media up in the juicy photo areas, or if you're a fan, you know, always expect that things are gonna go wonky on you, and you know, have in mind an escape route already in your head. Don't wait and try to figure it out, because it's too late then. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And so in this incident, it was weird. It was in a place where you think you would have been safe, but you know, it's just a sober reminder that whenever we're at the track, even if we're in the stands behind a catch fence, understand that it's a sketchy sport, man, and things can get ugly real quick. We're rambling on here a bit, but anyway, a very, very nice article from Mike. I encourage everyone to go and read it, and you know, follow his example. If you've got something you want to spout off about, you've got an opinion you want to share with people, write it up, send it to us.
Mm-hmm.
We'll put it up on the website for you.
Yep, it says for the fans, by the fans, for a reason, everybody. If you've got an opinion on whether it be Grand Am LMS merger, rally incidents, or whatnot, you know, just
close
please.
Closed cockpits?
Yeah, closed cockpits even. You know, if you've got an opinion, shoot it over to us. We'll proof it up, make sure it's all right. Can't be any worse than what I do. And and we will post it on the website for the world to read. So that's something you don't have to worry about. We'll take care of that part. But great article, Mike. I know you're back in the chat room. It was a great article. I really liked the read. So great stuff, and thank you for all that you do for us in dealing with the rally championship stuff that you know that we just kind of don't really have time anymore to cover. I mean, sad but true kind of thing. But let's go ahead and move on to the bread and butter, and let's talk IndyCar, because we're pushing time. We've got 10 minutes to somehow go through all of IndyCar. Yeah. But let's talk about Baltimore. We had a great weekend. Baltimore, you know, all the uncertainty of whether Baltimore was going to continue or not. And now we're back here, you know, back to the Baltimore Grand Prix. And it was a phenomenal event overall, I thought, yet again. But some of the big news heading into the weekend was that the push to pass delay that had been such a big deal beforehand was not a big deal this time because we got rid of the delay.
Yeah, yep. And did we miss it?
Not overly. I don't think so, but it's one of those things.
I did miss it a bit.
It's well,
and to be honest, when you're running 90% of the race under yellow anyway.
Oof. Oh yeah, that was a terrible thing. But it went from 5 seconds to 3.5 seconds at Mid Ohio and Sonoma, and then at Baltimore, after the drivers continued to say this is the most ridiculous thing of all time, they said, okay, well, we'll get rid of it.
Yeah.
So that was that.
Eliminated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but we went into Friday practice and we removed the chicane from before. Had some trouble with cars getting airborne over the railroad tracks. Had some very GRC moments, some global rallycross moments. Simon Pagenaud was all but on the last two wheels of his car at one point. I remember seeing that picture pretty clear. They tried to do a lot of things to try and mitigate that issue, whether it be grinding or whatnot. But the fact of the matter is this. They had to end up adding the chicane because they could not drive that straight line and hit that railroad track without big time problems.
Yeah, indeed. You know, they were getting airborne. Like you said, Simon Pagenaud got something like 2 feet off the ground with his front wheels. It was just ridiculous. They shut down that practice session immediately. They did things like tried to grind it again to try and minimize it a little bit more and sent the feeder series out there, and they were having the same issues, so they went ahead and added the chicane, and then they added some additional track space by opening it up the entry a little bit more. Yeah, kind of too bad, because last year Dario, you know, straight-lined it just to check for race control and said everything looked good. The drivers unanimously wanted that chicane out of there. Unfortunately, the track did not cooperate. Yeah, it's kind of hard to blame the series for making a mistake like that, because they cannot go and test cars on that surface except once they've built the track. So it's really one of those things where you just have to wait until the event, test it out, see what goes, you know, what way it's going to go, and then put up the chicane if necessary. Too bad.
You know, the thing about that chicane that made me the most nervous was the gap there in the wall, right near where everybody was tagging that wall. Did you notice that?
Mm-mm.
There was an opening in the concrete barrier, presumably for a safety crew. That was just forward, just up track of where it seemed everybody was slamming into that. And I kept thinking, you know, if someone's off trajectory just a little bit more, you know, this could be horrendous. The geometry was just all wrong, or rather just right for something really bad to go down.
NASCAR,
I don't know. Exactly, right?
Only we don't have roll cages and all kinds of fancy stuff, so we just die if we hit that.
Well, and that's what I was worried about, you know, because you hit that and you know, maybe you're not, you know, bouncing off and skittering down the track. Maybe you're just, boom, stop, dead, right there.
Yeah,
oh,
right.
Okay, maybe that was a poor choice of words, but you know what I mean.
Well, it's the truth.
I mean, it was sketchy in, you know, in all capital letters, and that's really what worried me more than the railway, you know, the railroad crossing itself, was where they had that gap situated. I think if they put that chicane in, they needed to move that opening somewhere else.
Yeah, and then the drivers were saying after the event that they would prefer, if they are going to put in a chicane, they need to get it set at such a place that the car is straightened up before it hit the rail tracks, because the car was still diagonal to the road when they were hitting the rail tracks, and therefore, you know, kind of losing control when they were pointed at the wall. So, some things to take forward to next year, if there is a next year. Attendance was down a bit from last year for this event, and you can understand why. It's been, you know, drugged through the media and, you know, changed promoters and just the whole nine yards. It was kind of a mess just to get it onto the schedule for this year.
But they had 150,000 people last year. And
yeah,
so
yeah.
Saying attendance was down, okay, maybe it was a little bit, but the crowds were still very strong. Tom Turk, one of our photographers, who had some fantastic shots over the weekend, I put up three three galleries of his stuff from the ALMS, the Mazda Road to Indy, and the IndyCar shots. Just remarkable work that he does. But anyway, I asked him about the crowd levels, and he said, "Hey, they look great." And there was a shot that Kevin Lee tweeted of the victory celebration, and I don't know that I can pull it up here real quick.
I'm sorry.
It's on my Twitter feed somewhere. But anyway, it it showed you know, the podium, you know, the stage. Then you got the all the sketchy unwashed photographers sitting there in their little crop clump, grumbling and cussing like we do. And then you had the sea of humanity behind it. That was just brilliant to see. You know, because what do you see normally at the Victory Circle celebration?
A confetti gun.
Yeah.
A Firestone Firehawk.
Confetti.
An Izod girl. And AJ Foyt.
Yeah, and all the unwashed, sketchy photographers, right?
Yes,
and that's it. You know, maybe a smattering of fans, but here you had hundreds of fans just swarming that entire area. It was great to
see. Well, it was a huge deal.
Absolutely
too, because of the way the race unfolded. Obviously, you know, big deal because Will Power started on pole position. Mm-hmm. Then we got into some kind of sketchy rain conditions. Part of the track was dry, part of the track was saturated, and you know, there was a lot of questions as to what kind of tires were to be taken. Unfortunately, Penske made the same gaffe they always make and messed up the strategy, causing Power to fall way back and lose his position as the dominant car of the race. And Ryan Hunter-Reay and the Andretti Autosport, what a sprightly bunch. I mean, because they just took the gamble and said, you know what, the hell with it. We're going with the Reds. And you know what, Ryan, if you want this championship, you need to sack up and drive this thing. And you know what?
Well, you know, what's your other option?
Well,
really,
everything that I've ever said about Ryan Hunter-Reay, that guy went out there, he sacked it the hell up, and he drove a hell of a race to take that race win. And put
fourth
himself
win of the season,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's unheard.
I mean, that, it really is. For an American driver at Andretti.
Yeah, and on
American
road course is no less. I mean, he's dominating a lot of the road courses and finishing well when he's not winning. I mean, he's had great success this year, and that team just, I mean, it blew me away how good they were able to call that race and give him that chance to win, and now we head into Fontana, and the championship's not so certain.
Well, and look at it this way. You know, look what Ryan Hunter-Reay won over. Will Power was the dominant car all weekend. He was the fastest car on the track. But again, like you said, a pit stop gaffe where they didn't take the right tires, where they it's just ridiculous. Once again, yeah, Will Power, right after the race, he went straight to his team, straight to his pit, and he said, "What was up with that pit stop? Why'd you give me those tires?"
And they're like, "Oh, because we're garbage."
We are
in the clutch anyways.
Here's the deal. You've got half the track wet, half the track dry. Of course, exactly what type of tire is that ideally suited for?
Dries. And I'll tell you why. Only half the track is dry, and only half the track's wet. So you get 50-50 dry wet. The shower was not that, like, holy cow, that the track wasn't going to dry quickly. I mean, it's like any time you get on those streets, you know, any streets in your town, if cars run over it enough, it's eventually going to dry out quickly if the shower is not a sustained shower. And this was not a sustained rain. This was a quick, there was obviously showers in the area. It was a quick dump, and it was heavy in some areas, and it was sketch. It was very sketch to stay on slicks. But at the same point in time, you know, the thing that you have to do is look long term. You know,
I think, hang on, because I think for the tires that they had available to them, you're absolutely right. Okay, I think, you know, Power's who is calling Power Strategy? Is it Cindric?
Is it Cindric? I don't know.
No, whoever it was,
they botched it. They blew it big time.
Well, here's
My question was, if you had the full range of compounds and tire choices. Of course, what is the perfect tire choice for those conditions? And it's not the slicks, not even the reds. It's not the full wets that they have.
It's the inters, and they don't have inters.
It's intermediates, right. And this is a perfect reason why I would like to see inters in the Eyes Wide IndyCar series. However,
because
I was
otherwise, because otherwise, every time you have a rain event during a race, it turns into amateur hour, like it did for like that 40
exactly,
lap stand.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, I had a great discussion with Shane Rogers on Twitter last night over this, and doggone it if he didn't assault me with logic and well-reasoned arguments on the internet of all places. Who does that? But, he made some very, very valid points that, there's a lot of significant and real financial reasons why we don't have inters. And I agree with him. I understand that. But, doggone it, from a competition standpoint, inters were the perfect tire for that situation, and the teams didn't have them available.
Well, so Penske gap number one kind of leaves Willpower in the dust and having to make up mad time, which he did. He was able to recover from it, but not get up into the top three. Penske gap number two, well, not really Penske, but Briscoe. The restart, the next to last restart, when Briscoe is leading the field down through the chicane. He chooses the left side of the track, which puts him on the outside of the turn instead of the inside, which is the preferred line or had been all day for the other eight or other seven restarts before that. And when the green flag waves, Briscoe sits there and he's like arguing on his radio, "Hey, he didn't pull up alongside me and look over and wave at me and all that stuff." And It's just absolutely ridiculous that Briscoe's sitting here complaining about Ryan Hunter-Reay. Yeah. And then Will Power after the race is complaining about Ryan Hunter-Reay. If they have any beef, it's about who waved the green flag and when. Because once that flag waves, you don't sit there and wait until you're pulled up alongside somebody before you go. That green flag means go.
All right.
Or flag later. That's the only green you get, man.
Hunter-Reay didn't wave. He chucked the deuces when he went blowing by.
Well, and not only Hunter-Reay, but Hunter-Reay, Pagenaud, and what was it, Franchitti behind him? Or who was it? Three people just streamed right by Briscoe. What are you thinking, buddy? Well, Briscoe was sitting here thinking, everybody's got to line up alongside me, and then the green flag's going to wave when I start to accelerate. The green flag didn't wave when he started to accelerate. The green flag waved long before he started to accelerate.
Yeah.
So, if anything, he has a beef with the flagman.
Yeah, true. Well, it was great that RHR took the win, took the gamble. He was able to take the win for the race. Followed. Well, does somebody have the results up? Because I'm not going to download the PDF.
yes, I have the results up here. Waiting. Okay, Ryan Hunter-Reay for the win. Ryan Briscoe finished second. He was able to recover from getting passed by Simon Pagenaud, and maybe it was Scott Dixon.
I don't think Dario was anywhere.
Yeah, you're right. He was able to move back up to second. Third, Simon Pagenaud. Fourth, Scott Dixon. Rubens finished fifth after muscling Willpower out of his way.
That was awesome, by the way.
That last restart. It's like,
he's like, "Oh, you kick ass at Champ Car and IndyCar? Well, guess what? I was an F1 douche." Bam! Door check. Yeah, I was bye.
he was pretty apologetic about that after the race. He felt pretty bad about that move because he pretty much relied on Willpower not hitting him to make that work. So anyway, kudos to him for taking the spot, and too bad, Will, because that puts you even further back in the points. Well, I shouldn't say back, but less ahead in the points. Oriel Servia for 7th, Tagliani for 8th, EJ Viso 9th, Elio 10th. Interesting race. I thoroughly enjoyed it between the rain events and watching all the yellows and the more yellows. And
oh my god, maybe, I was so mad.
Maybe we do need enters.
I told him, I said, usher in the ass clowns. I was like, because look at this, this is garbage. Yeah. I was so mad. I was in the process of trying to get ready to leave that day. And I was like, you know what? If this happens one more time, I'm going to clean the garage because I don't have time to sit and deal with this shit. So,
yeah. Well, where that puts us in the points, Willpower is 453. Ryan Hunter-Reay is at 436, 17 points back. Elio Castroneves and Scott Dixon are out of contention. Even scoring max points, which would be 53, that does not... Yeah, they basically need to be able to score 40... they need to be able to score... Yeah, anyway... I'm not making sense here. Sorry about that. Willpower automatically scores 12 points.
How many beers now?
Well, I'm just trying to put this in terms that I understand. Willpower automatically scores 12 points for just showing up next weekend, which makes it mathematically impossible for Elio or Scott to be able to catch up. So it's between Will and Ryan Hunter-Reay. Ryan Hunter-Reay is 17 points back, going into an oval where he's had success this year and Will hasn't. Thoughts,
you know, it's not that Will has been unsuccessful on on the ovals, not like the previous year, and so, you know, I think that even though we might not see Power finish ahead of Ryan Hunter-Reay, I think he'll finish close enough.
Yeah,
that he'll still get the championship. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. We can get into this, into the nitty-gritty of it next week as we do the preview for Fontana. But Ryan Hunter-Reay has a really good shot. Willpower can, you know, can make a mistake. He could, you know, like over-crank his accelerator as he leaves the pits and hit the Motegi wall and do the old Roger Penske backstep in the championship standings like has been happening so often lately for some odd reason. But Ryan Hunter-Reay's got a good chance, but this is Will's to lose.
Yep, yeah, that's it. That's exactly the right way to put it. It's Willpower's race to lose, or championship to lose.
As far as our picks from last week, looks like nobody picked the winner. Ryan Hunter-Reay was the winner. Let's see, you and Sean both picked him to be second, so you got 10 points for it.
Yay.
I picked him to be third. That gives me 5 points for it, and no other points were scored.
Nice. So I've extended my lead over the one that matters.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Ouch!
I can taste the St. Elmo's.
Sick burn.
So Randy Bernard had some media availability on the weekend, and not a whole lot to say here, but he started hemming and hawing on the 19 races thing. Well, what I really meant was 19 total races, not 19 separate weekends.
Well, and that makes sense, because they were talking about doubleheaders previously. Because I know here we talked about how cool it would be if they did doubleheaders to do a sprint and feature type of thing like A1GP did.
Well, isn't one of the is Texas going to be the doubleheader event this year, or is it Iowa? Which one is having the doubleheader? Iowa
was
kicked around. I think it's back to Texas.
You know, the little Texas two-step thing, I don't think that went well. But, you know, if you do a 30-lap sprint in the heat of the day, you know, in the afternoon, or on Saturday, you know, having a Saturday night sprint race along with, you know, the truck series or whatever other series you want to bring. And then you have the, you know, 550-kilometer feature race, you know, on Sunday or Friday night, Saturday night, however it works. I think that could work out really, really well.
Yeah. Well, signs point to all 15 from this season coming back, then adding in adding in Houston, that gets us up to 16. Mm-hmm. Adding in a doubleheader at an oval, which it sounds like we're doing, that gets us up to 17. Then we're talking about Pocono for next year, and the Pocono track president was in attendance, so I'm going to say that that's at least a likelihood.
Well, and I'm hearing from other sketchy sources that that I have that mm-hmm. they're looking at the Independence Day weekend.
Ooh, very nice.
I think that could work out really, really well. No, that I don't would know that Pocono ends up being your other doubleheader. I think the other doubleheader may be a road circuit.
Certainly not. Yeah, I think the other doubleheader has to be a road circuit. Don't know which one that is. Go forward with that. But the other thing Randy Bernard talked about was the parts row and the 20% reduction in cost. Still no formal announcement on that, but he was hinting at it again. So, well, again, we'll just wait and see the details of it, because it's probably going to mean an extension of the deal with Dallara, or Dallara just, you know, getting the rubber stamp on the lights chassis.
Do you mind some prognostication here?
Go ahead.
This 20% reduction in cost
mm-hmm.
comes if and only if Dallara gets a nod for the lights chassis.
Yeah, that's my prediction. Kind of what I was hinting at as well. And that makes a lot of sense, because, you know, volume makes up for loss in profit on individual pieces. Yep. So, not worth talking a whole lot about, but EJ Viso has not been too happy with his results this season.
I don't think any KB car has.
Yeah, and I think that's a common thing, because, you know, we were talking about Rubens, and he basically said, he's going to be back next year, but he's not saying anything about who with, probably Honda. Not really excited about the KV this season, and you have to feel for Tony Kanaan, because he's strapped into a deal with KV, and it looks like Viso and Rubens are bailing ship as quickly as they can.
Yeah.
But Viso's saying he's considering starting his own team, because he has a lot of sponsorship money, but he wants to take it somewhere where he feels he's getting value for it. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is Viso capable of bringing value to those sponsors by himself in a team effort?
Yes, given who his sponsors are and how big Viso is in Venezuela. I think his starting his own team, here's a scenario I could see playing out. He starts his own IndyCar team with him as a driver and one other car, maybe not now, but maybe in the future. And continuing the partnership with Juncos Racing, and bringing up the Star Mazda guys that Juncos Racing has right now. They got, what, four cars in Star Mazda. Bringing those up into their fledgling Indy Lights team. When we talked with Ricky Juncos at Iowa, thrown out there the idea of going into USF 2000, and he said, of course, that's the next natural step. Not mm-hmm. that they're committing to next year. They want to do this slowly and methodically. But eventually, I could see Ricky Juncos and EJ Viso partnering to be like a South American Andretti Autosport.
Oh, nice.
Where they're tapping into young talent from Chile and Venezuela that Juncos Racing already has programs in place for. And then eventually bringing them up to Team Viso in the Izod IndyCar Series. That scenario makes complete and total sense to me. And I'd love to see it, to be honest. A lot of people say, well, we need more American drivers. We need more American drivers. Well, we need more American owners doing the recruiting and investment that people like Ricky Juncos and EJ Viso are doing.
Yeah, right now the only
Michael
owner
Andretti are doing
exactly the only owner that we have in the U.S. Open Wheel Series that really is doing that is Andretti, because he's doing it from the ground up. You could say Sarah Fisher's kind of doing it as well, but you know, she has loose ties with a USAC effort because of Kyle O'Gara, her nephew by marriage. Is that right? I can't remember. Anyway, moving on, we've got some silly season talk. The active imagine of one R. Miller put together some silly season chat, and the biggest bombshell out of it is that Simon Pagenaud turned down Roger Penske for a 2013 seat because he's tied into a very locked up contract with Schmidt Hamilton.
I don't know, turned down.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, said I can't get out of this.
I would say that I would go even one further and say that Pagenaud's just fine where he's at. I mean, that team is up for. I mean, if you look at it, Schmidt, that's really a rookie team, honestly. It was left over of what used to be the Fast team, but given the new chassis and everything, I mean, that's a new team for all intents and purposes. And so, I mean, and they have performed brilliantly.
We already know that Sam Schmidt runs a proper motorsports organization.
And we know that Simon Pagenaud is a proper racing driver.
Absolutely.
And he is
strong. Strong rumors are putting Rubens at Schmidt Hamilton next year.
That's an excellent pairing.
Exactly. Great pairing, great team that's already proven itself. Good place to be. But what that means is Briscoe is likely out at Penske, and that certainly wasn't helped by his long nap in the restart zone this weekend. But Briscoe has actively been out talking with other teams since July. Sounds like he's been actively looking into Bobby Rahal. And he's also been actively looking into the seat that will be vacated by Rahal Jr. So there are a couple of people. It sounds like he's been actively talking with three teams. Not sure who the third was. So he knows he's most likely out at the end of the year. And Ryan Hunter-Reay has been offered the Penske seat. So the question is this all active imagination of R. Miller putting together thoughts and ideas that kind of coincide with some of the things he's heard? Or is this actually going on? Is Ryan Hunter-Reay at this point deciding between staying at Andretti, the team who basically has supported him amazingly, or moving to Penske, the team who is floundering with their championships for the last several years now? Hard decision.
I slightly disagree, Mike, and I know it's rare that we disagree. It's usually Doug. Mm-hmm. But I will disagree, and I say that RHR has no... I would say that the choice has already been made for him. You stay with Andretti. Andretti made you. Andretti gave you the opportunity when nobody else would give you the opportunity, and they have busted their ass this year to put you in a position to win that championship.
Let me go another way, though, with that, and just I agree, but let's be careful with that, because Tony Kanaan made Andretti. Tony Kanaan went out of his way to continue with Michael Andretti.
True.
He turned down an offer to go to Ganassi to stay with Michael Andretti.
True.
And when things didn't quite work out, Andretti bailed on him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of hard to just say, ooh, I'm going to be faithful to Michael, because Michael wasn't faithful to his drivers in the past. So,
look at who's on the team, though. You've got Hitch, which is obviously he's a superstar of the making. But you've got Marco, who obviously has not set the world on fire, as much as it pains me to say that. But, you know, he hasn't. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I think that Hunter-Reay is going to always be... He's always going to be the lead guy while with Andretti, much like you said TK was. But at the same point in time, it's like, I don't think... I would rather stay at Andretti, where I know I'm top dog, vice going to Penske, where I could just be snagged up in the market to not deny them another championship, basically.
Well,
it's like, because then you've got to worry about Will Power, who is God at that team. Castroneves, who anytime the 500 rolls around, he's going to be the favorite son to win that race, to make him in, you know, to try to help put him into the four-time club, you know, and obviously Briscoe. I mean, he's basically going to be taking Briscoe's seat, and look at what they've done with Briscoe this year. They don't give a damn about him as much as they try to say.
Let's just leave this conversation at one thing. We know he's not going to make a decision until after the championship is over. And once that's over with, if he wins a championship, you know, why would you leave Andretti? So, fun stuff.
Yeah.
The other thing that's been circulating is that Dragon Racing and Sebastian Bourdais are working towards finalizing a 2013 deal as early as they can. Yeah, no big surprise there. It's a good relationship, a good partnership. The only question is Dragon, can you keep sponsorship now after
P-Gate?
Urinating on ladies.
What we should have had JD and John do is play that. What was it? The Saturday Night Live skit from whatever. It was the R. Kelly stent R. Kelly was getting in trouble for peeing on people. They need to play that song.
IndyCar's R. Kelly.
Oh, there it is. He's R. Kelly, and every time.
Wow. I thought you were referring to the Phil Hartman game skit on Sprockets one time when he was dressed up as a German cross-dresser and named Susan, and he tried to woo somebody saying, "First, I will knock you out, throw you on the ground, and pee on you," chanting, "House on fire, house on fire, put it out, put it out." If you remember that, send Sean a tweet.
Yeah, I was probably not alive.
Anyway, go on, gentlemen.
All right, Doug, you literally have like 4 minutes for Mazda Road Indy.
Okay.
Go.
Well, very quickly, Gilles de Ferran comes up with an Indy Lights bid. It's a sexy looking car. It really is.
Yeah.
But he admitted it's going to be expensive. It's going to be high performance, which means it's going to be a stopper. You know, that's it. He's out. Indy Lights has enough problems right now with cost containment, in that they hardly have any at all, and that's why we're seeing grid sizes barely over a dozen. It is the only design to have elements to abate wheel interlock like the IndyCar does. So it does have that element in its favor, but I mean, DeFerrin's bid doesn't say Dallara on top, and so it's not.
Yes.
Pure and simple.
So clearly, the Dallara car series is not going to pick them.
No. USF 2000. We'll talk more about the championship later. But the advantage goes to Brabham. I just wrote an article about this, and I'll. Here in the next couple of days, I'll be putting up another article about Star Mazda and Indy Lights. But Piggott and Brabs split the two races this year, or this past weekend. Brabham won the first one, Piggott won the second one, or the other way around. They split it. But Piggott ended up DNFing in the one he didn't win. And that allowed Brabham to really stretch his lead. And so, you know, now it's really Brabham's race or Brabham's championship to lose. He has the advantage going to the last two races at VIR. He doesn't have a lock, but he definitely has an advantage. The national class has really tightened up. Mark Eaton, who we spoke with earlier in the week, go to the site, look at the most recent Inside the Helmet series post that we have, or if you subscribe to us on iTunes or through our podcast RSS feed, it's already in your player. We talked to him about his vast experience in the Formula Enterprise car and what it takes to win, especially at a street circuit. And his repeating theme was patience, 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 and it paid off in race number two, where he placed seventh overall in a Formula Enterprise car in about I think it was a 28-car grid. So that was the highest finish of any national class car of the season. And with that and the poor showings that race from his competitors, R.C. Anderson and Heinrich Rosenthal, that puts him right up in contention for the national class title. There are 10 points that separate Enerson, Peruseth, and Eaton. So BIR is going to be very, very interesting. Just like in USF 2000 and Star Mazda, the two championship leaders, Hawksworth and Karam, they split. Hawksworth won race one, Karam won race two. Karam caromed off the wall in, I think, turn four in race one. So whereas Hawksworth finished in P2 in race two, the race that Karam won, Karam had a DNF in race one. And so that all but hands the championship over to Hawksworth. They've got a few more races. They've got two coming up this weekend at Laguna Seca, and then one at Petit Le Mans weekend there in at Road Atlanta. But three races, and man, he's got a well. What is it? I think it's like 41 points to make up. It's going to be tough. It's going to be really, really tough, given how consistent Hawksworth has been. In Indy Lights, Tristan Vautier leads from pole, runs away from everybody, but the real interest was behind him. Gustavo Yakimin has the biggest freaking balls on the Indy Lights grid. I mean, bar none. He had the gutsiest, the most aggressive drive of the weekend. Just completely sucker punched Esteban. I think it was on lap three or four. There in turn three, just kind of hip checked him right into the tire barrier and moved his way through. Saavedra really screwed himself, thinking that he could get around Gustavo. Just got right up into his rear, under braking, saw he was going to hit him. So as soon as he touched, his back end came around, and he nosed it right into the wall. Basically removed himself from the championship. And so Saavedra's mistake, along with Esteban getting hip-checked into the tire barrier, basically hands the victory and the championship to Tristan Vautier. So look for Vautier to come away with the title at the Auto Club Speedway here, what, in a couple weeks, I think? And that's all I have for Mazda Road to Indy. We'll go in depth more about the championship battles next week, hopefully when we have more time and our motorsports in brief is actually brief.
Kind of hard when it's Spa, man.
Yeah, I agree. You got it. You got to do Spa.
And when Grand Am and ALMS are merging, or Grand Am is purchasing ALMS because they're failing one or the other.
Yeah, true. Well, we do have some broadcasts coming up here on ETV Live this week. Please tune in. Your home for the premier sim broadcasting on the web. Tomorrow night, actually, August 8th, we got the SSCA making a return. A deal has been done, or at least tentatively a deal has been done, so we may see some sponsorship change in that championship. But the SSCA Simulation Sports Car Associates IndyCar Championship moves to Mid-Ohio tomorrow for the road course there at Mid-Ohio. So I'm going to be driving my 75 car in that particular race at Mid-Ohio. So that's going to be awesome. So tune into that. It's going to start at the race starts at 8:30, I do believe, Central Time, so 9:30 Eastern, for fun around Mike's home track there. So hopefully me and the teammate can increase our championship lead, and or at least he can increase his championship, and we can try to make up some team championship points. And then we've got Friday night. We got the Friday Night Showdown, the popular Friday Night Showdown, probably one of the most popular broadcasts on ETV Live, coming to you live from the mecca of motorsports, Indianapolis Motor Speedway. J.D. Webb and Mike Conti in the booth calling the action for that particular race. And then Saturday, August 11th, going from 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m., we got the race department iRacing Le Mans Series 2012 Summer Tour. It's not going to be the 2 hours of Texas. I'm not exactly sure precisely what what we're going to be doing there, but we do have Le Mans Series action coming from there, so I've got some faulty information, so I apologize for that. But it's not August, so it's not going to be at Indianapolis. So actually, you know what? Just trash everything that I just said. But there will be. I do believe that there will be a. There will be an SCA race tomorrow, so I'm pretty sure that we've got a deal together for that. Stay tuned. I will actually post an article on Open Paddock this week giving you all the sim racing broadcasting details going forward, since obviously this is the wrong one. But I will fix that and post an article letting you know. So we will. But I do believe, again, that we will be at Mid-Ohio tomorrow, and I do believe there may be commentary. I know there was something in the works, so we will work hard to do that. So, but I will post that article. But we've run over time, guys. Thanks everybody for listening. Mike, Doug, as always, I want to say thank you, and I want to say also thank you to JD Webb and John Westling, who have been doing all the awesome streaming work for us here at ETV Live, letting Open Paddock be a live show. So thanks so much. So everybody, have a great night. Enjoy the week and the weekend of motorsport, and we will talk at you here very soon. So have a good night.